Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lamb today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, the risks and rewards of the FIRE movement. Is early retirement a dream worth chasing, or will scrimping only make you end up poor and lonely? Also today, the tax man sees an incredible spike in inheritance tax receipts, but what's behind it? UK debt reaches 2.4 trillion. Why record levels of debt interest matter, how it influences government decisions, and what next for borrowing levels. And a nice problem to have, but what do you do with £60,000 in a cash ISA paying just 0.4%? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, it's the dream, isn't it? To retire early, to leave behind the daily grind and sail off into the sunset. Or don some fancy gardening shoes and tend to your hydrangeas, whatever you want to do. But how much are you willing to sacrifice to get there? Now, an extreme saving movement known as FIRE has gained momentum in recent years. The mix of frugal tactics, aggressive investing, and maximising your income are unrealistic for most. And as critics say, one way to work yourself into loneliness. So, is it possible? Is it worth it? Now, Lee Boyce, you've been interested in the FIRE movement. Where did it come from?
Hi, Georgie. Yeah, the financial independence retire early movement is something that I've read a lot about in recent years. I find myself sometimes for fun just reading people's blogs or websites that have done this and social media. And it was born out from an early 90s book called Your Money or Your Life. And it was a kind of the theme of FIRE in there. It's kind of where this was born from. Fast forward to about 20 years later, internet era, social media era, people were sort of doing this more frequently and more people reading about it. And then that gets more people interested about it and more people doing it. So there's been this kind of this movement towards it. Now, what the movement actually is, to put it really simply, it's like extreme saving. And it's taking basically, usually the figure for this is about 70% of your income is saved. Now, that is a big chunk. A lot of people, financial experts will say you want to be saving somewhere between 10 and 15% of your monthly income. That's a kind of fairly standard amount that gets bandied around. 70% is obviously pretty hardcore version of that. You tuck that money away, you invest it, and then eventually you get a pot that's sizable enough that you can then retire early and start taking 4%. This is a golden number of this out of this pot that you've built every year, and you can retire early. You can sail off into this utopian retirement where, you know, you could do this potentially in your 40s or early 50s. Not that 65 is obviously the age that a lot of people have in their mind. That's getting pushed higher and higher in this country, especially. So a lot of people like the idea of being able to stick it to the man, as you say, retire early, live off that extreme saving that they've done. But it does involve a lot of discipline and it does involve being very frugal.
Saving 70% of your income. I mean, you said they're invested. I mean, is there an ideal of what to do? I'm thinking, do pensions count? Because, of course, if pensions count, then you have the practical issues of you need to be at least 55 to tap into your private pension. And, of course, 66 or 67 soon to be and probably older than that for your state pension. So you'd have to sort of make up the shortfall there. Where are we saving this 70% of our income?
Well, there's no hard and fast rule. You can make your pension part of this. Obviously, that is for a little bit later on down the line. And depending what your target age is, to take this early retirement. And as you say, it's the practicalities of where you put this money in and where you can go to make it grow. And actually, in the piece that I've written about this, I do point out here there's a lot of hurdles to jump, including things like stock market volatility, which is something that, you know, in the last 6 to 9 months, we've seen quite a bit of. You know, we do say that typically over a 10-year period, you know, if you invest, you're likely to make fairly decent returns on your cash, but it's not a completely guaranteed. So there is all of those kind of practical barriers of finding where to put this money, as you say. And this is where, you know, you want to go off and do some research and find out whereabouts it is to put this money. But it's a really interesting concept. And actually what I've realized is while I don't do this, I don't have the discipline and I don't really have the desire to save 70% of my income each month. No. I mean, that feels like it's going to be a big hit on my quality of life, the here and now quality of life. And as I point out in this column that I've written about this, it's that balance between money versus time. You know, what if something happens in a morbid kind of way in which I wasn't able to enjoy that money that I've built up? And living for the here and now is something that I like to do in balance with, you know, some strict savings. So while I don't save 70% of my income, I probably save something around 30, 35% of my income each month, which kind of, as I describe in my column on this, it makes me a kind of fire light, or as someone tweeted me, I'm kind of doing the fire, but without the E. So I'm not retiring early, but I'm kind of making those decisions where I'm trying to give myself a richer retirement at whatever age that might be. So that's one reason. There's two real reasons why I don't think this would properly work for me. Number one,
you're a bit old, aren't you, Lee?
Whoa, steady on.
Sorry, but you know, to retire early, they're talking about the 40s. You've only got yourself a few years, haven't you?
Whoa, steady on it.
Well, Simon and I are completely screwed.
Well, I've been saving pretty tidily, I would say, Georgia, over the last 10 years. Yeah, not 70% of my
income. You're in a good situation.
There's time. There would be time for me, don't you?
All right. All right, Lee.
the number one thing I would say is, it's about living modestly, right, and frugally. And we were touching on this in the podcast last week about, I'm not really someone that likes to keep up with the Joneses, and you know, I like to live within my means. And what I mean by that is, I'm not really too bothered about what car I drive. For me, it's a car that gets me from A to B. Mm. I'm not really fussed about having a much bigger house. I live in a 3-bedroom house. It's small, but it's perfectly fine. I'm not really bothered about all the rigmarole of moving to get a slightly bigger house with potentially one extra bedroom and whatever, a utility room, or whoopee, for an extra few hundred grand. Not really that fussed by that. But my kryptonite is holidays and travel, and it always has been. And actually, I do spend a fair chunk of my salary on holidays and on travel. And for me, it's an escape and I like to see the world. I'm in the prime of my life, Georgie, as you rightly pointed out just a minute ago.
That's exactly, you know, what I said, Lee, yeah.
To be able to do these things and take advantage. And I'm not saying that, you know, in my 50s and 60s, I wouldn't do that. But would I find it as enjoyable? I don't know. It's hard to, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, so I'm not sure. But while I'm young and nimble, like going out and doing these things and, you know, experiences with my toddler.
Well, that's important. It's important that you have kids, you know, so you want to create memories with them, not, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is it. And that's stuff that can rock your fire plans, you know, having children, you know, property ownership, job stability, unexpected bills. And, you know, this what I would describe as frivolous spending. And a lot of us do frivolous spending. We spend money on things that we don't particularly need for that short term boost of feeling good, you know, latest tech, clothes, that kind of thing. I could easily forfeit all of that kind of stuff. I don't need the latest tech. I'm not really fussed about clothes, but it is holidays. And I don't think that I could ever row back from how much I spend on my holidays because I just enjoy them too much. I enjoy planning them. I enjoy going on them. And every single penny I ever spend on a holiday is money well spent, in my opinion. Now, the second thing that I would say really factors into me not getting fully involved in this is actually job enjoyment. Now, a lot of people that do this will, you know, potentially be in a job that they hate and they've been stuck in it for a long time and they want to escape and they don't know how. And they might potentially do this, you know, you say stick it to the man, but actually just to escape their career, you know, get out and retire early and not have to do it anymore. And I completely understand that. But, you know, I have high job satisfaction and I have no plans of really wanting to wind down in my 40s or 50s. I just can't imagine it because I'm too passionate and enjoy doing this. But I know that.
All right, you big suck up there with your
editor. No, but you know, I'm potentially in the minority, you know, and there's a lot of people out there that might think actually this really would work for me because I want to get out and escape all this. So my takeaway from this fire stuff, and Tanya Jeffries wrote a great piece last weekend about it, which actually was what inspired me to write a column about it, is that it does cross over a lot of themes in my own life, you know, the living fairly frugally and saving as much as you can, for example. And in that reader comment section that we had in Tender Story, it was actually full of really, really good advice. And
you enjoyed that. You mentioned it in your article. What were some of the, because we've had some reader comments in the past, you know, on your articles, and they've not been as useful as what you found these ones.
No, and exactly. And actually, I love it when we have a story in which it's just full of commentators, not everyone agreeing on the same thing, but there's this friendly debate and there's some good like tips and advice in there. And I love that kind of thing. I love going in and seeing what our readers are saying and thinking about what they're reading. Now, one of the comments that I really liked in there, and I'll read out part of the comment, was there are so many concepts that overlap here. It's not just about saving. It is also about intentional living, reducing waste, consuming less, and living a simple life. I think that's a fantastic little comment that's in there. And that's totally right. And I definitely think I've got better at this in the last few years, maybe since the pandemic. It's just not frittering away money on stuff that doesn't potentially or particularly give me joy or happiness, and just accumulating too much stuff. I just don't really do that type of thing as much anymore. And sometimes it takes you a little bit later in life to maybe realize that. And actually, there is quite a lot of joy in watching a pot of cash swell, for example, even if it's just in the simple savings account. And I think I've realized that that gives me more joy than those short-term frivolous spending habits.
Well, it all really depends on what you're spending your money on and what you think is frivolous. So I don't really like a lot of stuff. I don't have a lot of stuff, but I do like, for example, spending money on, what am I doing at the moment? An art course, Spanish lessons, signed up to a psychology course. I was thinking of going hot air ballooning, right? It's about 200 quid. That's expensive. That money could help me retire early. But then I go, I don't necessarily want to live a quote unquote simple life. I want a fun life, joyful life.
I wouldn't describe those as frivolous purchases, though. I would describe those as life experiences that are good for your soul. You know, doing something
nicely.
Like an art course.
I like that.
Doing an art course is enhancing your life and it's giving you enjoyment. Hot air balloon might be something that's on your, you know, bucket list of things to do. Now, why would you forfeit that for the sake of saving that £200 and potentially being able to retire a tiny bit early with that £200? It's all about that balance. And I think that's what I've realized from reading a lot of this stuff. It's just about balancing out what you can do. And actually, one of the big criticisms about FIRE is that it's aimed really at rich people, people that are earning quite a lot of money and are comfortably living, you know, own their own home, for example, and have that as part of their plan, you know, as in they're paying off their home each month and then hopefully will be mortgage free as quickly as possible. You know, that's another consideration of this, which is why I talk about property ownership in this. And again, it's like whenever we talk about anything on this podcast, Georgie, there's never anything that's like a one size fits all for everyone. You know, for some people, this could really work. For some people, they simply, you know, in a cost of living crisis, don't have the spare cash to even think about, you know, this being an option. So, you know, it's hard to kind of say that this would work for everyone. I think you'd have to be the type of person that's very good at budgeting with a spreadsheet. Those kind of themes are good themes for anyone in any walk of life. It's just that you might not be able to save 70% of your salary, but even if you could save 7% of your salary and get in those habits that could give you potentially a brighter financial future, I think it's well worth reading about and it's well worth sort of seeing how people do this extreme saving.
I like what you wrote about you can't buy time and you can't buy health. And if someone's got a health condition, I'm very conscious of the fact that, you know, in my 50s and 60s, I may not be able to do the sort of things that I'm enjoying doing now. And I think that would be an utter shame to have got to that point and then realize that something's happened, perhaps an illness or you need to care for someone and you aren't able to enjoy your early retirement. And you've spent all that time frugally saving, not going out, not enjoying yourself. And I also agree it's for people that, like you said, well, one, rich, and two, don't enjoy their jobs. And I'd rather spend my time, because clearly you have to be pretty committed to do this. I'd rather spend my time looking for a job that I loved. And even if it meant I earned a little bit less, well, at least I love that job and I've got happiness and purpose in my life. Simon, your views fancy this?
I have thought about it in the past. We've written about financial independence you know, a number of times over the years. And I must admit, when I first started getting interested in this and thinking about it, I think I possibly got first exposed to it by the Munavator blog, which I'm always a fan of reading, right? And they've got some financial independence type people who've written on there before, and there's always a really good debate in the comments about it. But I did just, I think, ultimately come to the conclusion that it wasn't a practical course of action for me, possibly because I lack the discipline and also because I like spending too much. I don't like spending too much. I like spending too much, if you see what I mean. And I don't want to cut back to the level that I would need to in order to do this and sacrifice what will probably be the best years of my life when I'm younger, fitter, healthier, my kids are young. We can do all those things together that you can't ever get back. If I had made the decision, so I love snowboarding, right? And skiing, okay, but mainly snowboarding. Every year we go on a snowboarding holiday, ideally two. One weekend, me and my wife, long weekend, and then a week or potentially longer if we can do it with the kids. That's the best time of the year to me. If I were to sacrifice those, I could save quite a lot more money every single year. But I wouldn't be able to get that back. Like, what price do you put on that? Teaching your kids to ski and snowboard and the time you spend with them in the mountains and things like that. Now, you don't have to go completely crazy on it. Okay. Now, I know people who go on family ski holidays where they're going to one of those places where everything's included in the price and someone's going to help look after your kids and the food's in there and it's a fancy hotel and the flights are in it and stuff. And they would spend an order of magnitude more than I would do on either cheap flights or driving to the Alps, finding an apartment to stay in yourselves, sort out the ski hire, sort out the ski lessons and everything else yourself. Probably don't really eat out that much. Ideally, if you're staying somewhere near to the piste, you go back for lunch on quite a few days, because the cost of lunch in the Alps every single day for a family of four, well, I mean, that's probably like an extra year of financial independence if you don't do that. So yeah, there's those things. And I'm not willing to give that stuff up. I wrote about this in my column the other week about taking my daughter to see the Rolling Stones. Ultimately, that is an extravagance. £100 a ticket. That is frivolous spending. But is it really? Because it's an experience. My dad first took me to see the Stones when I was 11. And he said to me, "You're really lucky to do this. This is probably the last chance you'll get to see them." I think I'm on time number 10 now. And I took my daughter when she's 11. She'll remember that for the whole rest of her life. I'll remember it for the rest of mine. Probably not going to lie there on my deathbed in years to come going, "I wish I hadn't spent that £200. So I think there are all those factors that come into it. And then also the fact that when I sat down and started working out the numbers some years ago, I reckon I could have got much closer to this. But I've just sat here and done some what would have been called back of a fag packet maths, but it's obviously a notebook nowadays. And I've worked out that after my mortgage comes out, the money that I put in for our household expenses, which never seems to be enough, especially at the moment, and then the cost of me going to work, so the commuting and general like living expenses of going to work, and bear in mind, I don't go out to lunch every day when I go to work, I'm only left with about 50% of my post-tax salary anyway. So I couldn't save 70% of it, even if I wanted to. I mean, we could probably try to cut back on the household essential stuff, but we don't use that household essentials pot that goes into a joint account for general casual spending. And our grocery bill isn't that big. Obviously there's the Waitrose trips before you invite people around for a barbecue or something, where all of a sudden you've spent the next month's grocery bill. And I do get in trouble for that, but I don't think there's that much I could shave out of it. So it would be difficult. You have to make a number of different choices in life. But I think that one of the really important things about it is, firstly, you need to think about this level of saving. Is it post-tax income, right? Because if you do it pre-tax, then that's going to make it even harder. But what about your pension? where's your, are you calculating it after you've saved money into your pension? Because if you're saving money into your pension and you're putting 5% of your salary into your pension and your employer's putting 5% of your salary into your pension, well, that's an extra 10% that's being saved before you start calculating that post-tax number. And you can't get your pension until you're 55, and it's going to be 57 soon, and it's probably going to go up higher. So if you want to be financially independent and retire early, then you can't rely on the pension. You need the money that you can access. But at some point, that pension will kick in. So that money that you can access earlier on is maybe worth it. And they talk about this overall pot of 25 times your annual spending. So if you can drag your annual spending down, you need a little bit less in the pot and so on. And it's obviously slightly difficult for everyone. But of course, you can work a bit. You could be really extreme on this. And what I love about anything like this is like this, there's a totally extreme end of it. It almost a sort of cult-like type thing to it. But there's also the bit where you can be a bit more practical about it. You can go, well, I could do some work. I could earn some money. And so at what point would I need to do that? And as Lee said, it's definitely one for the people who like to do their modelling and their spreadsheets. But I think on a broader level, one of the things I think almost all of us could get better at, and we talked about this on the podcast last week about people's relationships with money, is about how you manage your day-to-day and week-to-week spending. And most of us really don't engage with that very much, considering it's probably one of the most important financial aspects of our lives. I mean, you can call it budgeting, or you can call it having a spending plan. You can call it being smarter with your money, or whatever you want to do. But there's a few key things that you need to do. And it's sort of working out where your money goes. So where is all that money going? And actually, it can be quite surprising when you start breaking that down. And you need to look at it over a big enough period. You can't just look at 1 month. You need to probably go back 6 months, a year. And it's much easier to do nowadays. You know, hit that button on your online banking, download it into a spreadsheet, do some very basic spreadsheet stuff. You're talking to a man here who really is not an Excel wizard, but you can sort of work it out, and then you can, or just do it with a piece of paper and a pen. And then once you've worked that out, where your money's going, compare that to where you think it should be going.
Yeah.
Is it going to the places you want it to be going, or is some of it just being leached out of your account? And then I think also, and I'm sort of stealing this from someone here. I read a column a while back. This was in a rival publication. It was in the FT Money. Okay. And it was a guy called Jason Butler who writes there. Mm-hmm. And he said about this CEO approach, and it's something that stuck with me ever since. And he said, cut, earn, and optimize. So cutting out unnecessary spending. Lee, you'll like this. Earning can mean earning more through overtime or selling unwanted possessions.
Go broke people, never go broke. I don't good booksellers from Lee Boyce.
Yeah, and optimizing the essential spending, the stuff you can't cut, make sure that you're spending as little as possible. So we talked about standard variable rates, didn't we, last week? Your mortgage, make sure you're on the best possible mortgage rate. Make sure you're not overpaying for your insurance. Stop paying all that money for a mobile phone. Do you really need that car on the PCP finance deal and all that kind of stuff? And then, you know, just try. So you've got a sort of plan, and then you just need to try to stick to it. And it is surprising at what a difference that would make to people. But it's also surprising at how easy it is to drift away from managing your finance as well. And I will hold my hands up here, and I have definitely drifted away from managing my finance as well. I need to sort them out better, because I'm not paying enough attention to this stuff, because I'm just justifying that on the basis too busy, just full stop too busy. But definitely drifted away from it.
I think it's interesting you're talking about the day-to-day spending. I think a lot of that is habits, and those are notoriously hard to break. But also the problem with me is, let's say I did, Lee, get that hot air balloon trip for 200 quid, which is, let's be honest, it's extravagant. And then I think, well, what is the point in me cutting out, you know, the lunch at work or the coffees or going out for drinks with friends when I'm just going to splurge it? And I feel like, well, I'm back to square one. What was the point in that?
Well, what you do, Georgie, is you don't spend £5 every day on lunch, and then you tuck that into your hot air balloon fund. once you hit your hot air balloon fund, then you won't feel guilty. Then I go on.
Yeah, but that is very truly. It's very true. But I think it's just like it's any habit. They're just so difficult to break, and it's just an engagement thing. You don't really think about it, and you don't think that those sort of, you know, £5 lunches add up, but they really do. It wouldn't take very long to get to that. Just one thing, Simon. I get the frugal tactics. I think most people understand the maximizing your income. Yeah, we've explained that. Aggressive investing. I mean, I think we've got investing, but what does aggressive investing mean?
The opposite of probably what most people think it means, because a lot of the financial independence movement is very much wedded to the lowest cost possible broad index tracker fund style of investing, not aggressive investing, as in get your braces on, get on the phone, shout, buy and sell as loudly as you can, even though you're just actually probably using the app. But it's all about keeping costs down, because that's the one thing you can control. Mm-hmm. You can't control investment performance, but you can control costs. And they make a big difference, especially once you factor in compounding over the years. Keeping an eye on that stuff, and then also looking at this element of what am I trying to do here? I'm trying to get to the point where I've got freedom, and it is my best route to freedom thinking that I can beat the market. But actually, can I really? How easy is that? Do I just invest in the market and allow the market to do the work over the long term? Because this is a long-term thing. And so then going, you know, down that passive route, because whilst you might manage to pick an investment trust or a fund or the right shares that do beat the market, the damage that could be done to your portfolio and wealth by making the wrong choices is potentially quite substantial and could see you fall quite a long way behind the market. It's quite difficult to keep track if you are regularly investing, be that either on a monthly basis or lump sums every so often, or things like the lumpy bits and everything like that, of your actual performance, because you've got money going in. And so it's difficult to work that out. So a lot of people probably don't realize how they lag the market, and they just don't do as well as the stock market. And that probably just sticking their money into a cheap index tracker fund would be the best idea. And not just one in the FTSE, probably a global one. And yes, those global funds have fallen this year, but they, you know, they've gone up lots in years before and stuff like that. And I say that as a man with a portfolio full of actively managed investment trusts, funds, and a share picked portfolio and all those other things. And I'm pretty sure that I'm not beating the market. I think I could do, though.
I was going to point out here as well, Georgie, that we do have quite a generous tax-free ISA allowance. You know, we can shield investments away from the taxman up to a certain degree. Now, £20,000 stocks and shares ISA limit per year is quite a meaty amount of cash. I mean, that's £100,000 over 5 years. That's £200,000 over 10 years. And that's without factoring in any kind of compound and investment growth. And in order to max that out, you'd need to save about £1,650 a month. That's quite a large chunk of cash, and depending on what your salary is. And then you can go into something that's quite low cost in order to try and attain this and do this. But there's no guarantee that you can definitely get the investment growth that you need and continue with that investment growth. And that's why when you asked me at the start of this segment where the money could go, I was a little bit wishy-washy with the answer, because to be honest, I don't have the answer. It's really difficult to predict and know. You know, you could say that you expect to get 4% growth or whatever each year, but the practicalities of that is that you might have 1 year of stock market losses, and then you might have 1 year where it goes up 20%. You know, it's just really hard to completely gauge. And that's why it's good to go off and read some people that have done this and look back at what they've done over the last 10, 15, 20 years, which is why I was so interested in the reader comments, who people that were giving kind of practical advice on how to do this, because they have the experience and the know-how of doing this for a long time and can give figures of what their growth has been over a long period of time. But I mean, you know, that ISA allowance of 20 grand tax-free is massive. And I think if you can max that out every month, I mean, you're well on the way to be financially independent and retiring early, in my opinion.
Mm. All right, well, another consideration, save too much in your pot and sadly pass on too soon. And what happens? Well, the tax man's likely to get a bigger chunk of whatever you've saved, aren't they? We're just going to talk about inheritance tax now. Not just a tax on the wealthy anymore, though. The government took in $1.8 billion between April and June this year. That's 19% or $300 million more compared to last year. What's to blame? Increasing house prices. Simon, not just a tax on the rich anymore.
No, I mean, it is, though. Actually, it is a tax on people who are comparatively rich, right? You can basically,
what does it mean to be rich?
As a couple, you can shield £1 million in total. So you have your nil rate band, right? Okay, and then you have your own home allowance, you know, your own residence allowance, basically, and that tops it up to about £1 million, right? Okay, so the extra amount is £175,000 per person from 2021 to 2026.
If you're in a couple, though, Simon, that's if you're a couple,
married couple, civil partners, okay, which maybe
more divorces now, Simon. You know, single people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I know, but yeah. this was the idea of this is that it would basically, you know, protect family homes to a greater extent because of rising house prices. If you have an estate of £1 million. Between two people, you are comparatively wealthy, full stop. Okay, but there is an issue whereby high house prices in a large chunk of the country has pushed a lot of people who would not consider themselves to be particularly wealthy and have decent but relatively modest lifetime savings into the inheritance tax bracket. And they're on their estate, there's 40% on every extra pound above that million. And actually, people need to be a bit careful with this main residence band, because once you go up to 2 million, it starts being taken back off you. Now, the thing about inheritance tax is it catches the wealthy, but not the really rich. The really rich, once you get to a certain level of wealth, and there has been research done on this, they start to pay a relatively lower rate of tax because they start getting into the realms of inheritance tax planning. And, you know, the simplest way to avoid inheritance tax is to give your money away before you die. And you have 7 years. If you've survived for 7 years, there's no tax liability. If you die within those 7 years, there's a taper relief. The other one, which actually you should think about before you do that, is to spend some money on yourself. It's very difficult for people who've lived frugally and been prudent and saved and worked hard through their working lives when they reach their retirement years and they go from what is in jargon called the accumulation phase to the decumulation phase, i.e. you need to stop having your wealth growing every month and start having it coming down, because every bone in their body is telling them that at the end of the month they need to have a little bit more left and they need to save it. Now, if you've got an inheritance tax liability and you know you've got an inheritance tax liability, ideally, unless you're totally cool with it, which some people are, because there is an option where you just do nothing, tax is paid, you're dead, you won't even notice, then you need to have less money at the end of every month. But that's really hard for people to do. And actually, the way to think about it, a financial advisor once told me this. He said, I always tell my clients who know they're going to end up with an inheritance tax bill and probably one that's going to, you know, run into maybe a couple of £100,000, that they should fly business class. And they always say to me, well, I can't afford to do that. I can't afford to fly business class. And he said, but it's 40% off. Would you fly business class if it was 40% off? And they go, yeah, I would fly business class if it was 40% off. It's like, well, if you don't spend that money, tax man taking 40% of it. So spend the money on yourselves. Treat yourselves. You worked hard and you saved hard your whole life and you saved all that money into your pension, for example. in order to have a nice retirement. So don't scrimp and save. Enjoy yourself in your retirement. Treat yourself. Don't go out and blow all your cash. I'm not advocating that. But if you know you've got an inheritance tax liability, then, you know, do that. And one of the things to think about is people think, oh, but what if? What if? What if? What if? What if I have to go into care? And so on. Well, actually, if you've got, for example, a lot of people have defined benefit pensions. If you've got a defined benefit pension, a guaranteed income coming in every month, how much of the care costs would that cover? Many people will have a house that's worth a lot of money. Ultimately, at the end of the day, there is the opportunity that if you have that scenario, you could sell the house. You could even go down the route of something like equity release. Not advocating that, but saying that there are options. And there's people overestimate the what if money that they need. And you know, maybe it's better to spend it and try to give it away, because the government's coming after it and they're getting more and more and more of it.
And they will do with every with year that rate passes. Frozen.
And, you know, that we've seen this big spike in IHT receipts, and that's going to continue to happen. So the government took in an additional 300 million between April and June 2022 compared to last year. 19% rise in the receipts took the income up to £1.8 billion for the period. And that's going to keep going up because the levels are frozen and house prices have gone up a lot. The difficulty for most people is that the house represents such a huge chunk of the overall wealth that it's actually quite difficult for them to bring themselves down below the level of it. But, you know, as I said, if you got this problem, it's a nice problem to have, right? Mm. First of all, just remember, it's not a problem. It's an opportunity, because it means that you're wealthy. And spend some money, enjoy yourself, and maybe give some of it away, and enjoy giving it away whilst you're still alive. And, you know, yeah, maybe don't fret it. Don't sweat the small stuff, Lee said last week. I mean, the small stuff is not 40% tax on money that you've worked really hard to have, but it is a nice problem to have.
Lee, what's your views about inheritance tax? Should we cut?
I remember we had this chat on the podcast a few years ago, Georgie, about how it was rated like the most unpopular tax, despite the fact that so few people actually realistically pay it. And when you look at other tax receipts from HMRC, actually, it is a bit of a drop in the ocean. However, what's happening, as Simon points out there, is that more people are getting suckered in to paying IHT and realise actually that it is quite a big hit. And recently, a family friend was talking me through their grandparents that, you know, both had passed away, and told me about how much the inheritance tax bill was, pretty much all made up of property. Just the one home that they lived in that they bought like 60, 70 years ago that has grown in value so much that it got hooked into this. And then I think most of the other money was just basically simply in a current account. It wasn't invested. It wasn't doing anything else. And grandparents probably, this needs to be like an opposite of FIRE, doesn't it? About how you strip away your money in your later years if you feel like you've got too much of it, and what you do. And I think a lot of people don't potentially act until it's too late. And I think the reason why it's quite an unpopular tax is that while a lot of people might not ever be affected by it, it does sometimes feel like a bit of a tax on being successful, you know, building something of your life. And I think it's a kind of dangerous game, because you do have seriously wealthy people that, you know, are worth tens of millions of pounds, you know, and then, as Simon says, they start to get into the planning stage because they don't want a large chunk of that cash just going straight to the tax man. I mean, it just feels like, you know, an incredible level of money. But then you get the people that it is just tied up in the property, and they don't really know what to do or what to happen to prevent that. And I think that's what a lot of people aren't so happy about. And with the frozen bans and with house prices going up, more people getting suckered into it, I think there might be a bit more backlash in the next few years about this.
I guess the argument some people might make about the increased receipts, and to what you've said about it's a tax on working hard, is, well, those people who are sitting in homes worth a huge amount of money because of house price inflation, particularly in areas like London, they haven't really done anything, have they?
Yeah, but they bought their home.
Yeah, the same way everybody else did for similar sum.
As a place to live, potentially, not as an investment, not as a monetary amount. It's somewhere that they bought to live in. And is it there?
Yeah, but they've not worked hard for that. They worked hard initially, but they've kind of lucked out due to location, no?
They did. They paid the mortgage, though, which is one of the things that often gets said. But I think that one of the things you have to reflect on there...
Plain devil's advocate, then.
Yeah, no, but I think one of the things you have to reflect on there, and this is a difficult one, actually, because there then comes the question of, well, what about the people who live in the other parts of the country? But there is an issue whereby, yes, of course, you've just benefited from this, but the only bet you can't, you don't really see any benefit from this. You live in the house. The only benefit you can get from this is if you sell up, move into a much smaller house, or normally in most cases, move out of the area that you live in. The benefit comes when you die and you're dead. That's, I don't know whether you can qualify a benefit if you have to be dead to get it, right? But the problem is that you then potentially have a family, you have children who can't afford to own a home in the area that they grew up in, which is where the kind of inheritance things comes in. And for many people living in those parts of the country, the only reason they actually have any opportunity to live in the same area they grew up in is because the bank of mom and dad has had to step in and hand over some cash. I mean, ideally, we'd be in a situation where house prices hadn't gone completely bananas over the last 20 years, and we didn't have such ridiculously expensive property compared to wages. And so we weren't sitting here talking about this. Yes, they didn't work for that money, but the fact that we have such high house prices and it's so difficult for people to get on the housing ladder and they're paying massive multiples and they can't do it themselves, even though they've got good jobs and they earn good money and they save money. And so they're having to go to their parents and their grandparents and stuff like that, is because of the mismanagement of the economy and our monetary system over the past 20 years. And ultimately, you know, were individual people responsible for that? No, probably not.
New boys?
Yeah, I mean, it's all a fair argument. And again, it's just like you can never completely, no one's circumstances are always completely the same. And there are a lot of factors at play, including things like, you know, potentially going into a care home and the absolutely extravagant cost of going into a care home in this country and all other sort of things like that. And I don't know, I just get the impression from, you know, a lot of people that they find it quite an unfair tax, perhaps the level in which the tax, you know, is taxed at, and potentially, you know, 40% on someone that's worth, you know, past £10 million on, compared to someone 40% it's worth, you know, a home that's worth £1 million and got some cash in the bank. It's quite a big difference, in my opinion.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Simon. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. How have the markets been this week? What have we seen?
Well, not actually that bad. I mean, we had a 40-year high inflation reading from the UK, which is crazy to say. It's not even a shock anymore, as crazy as that sounds. A little bit of a silver lining in that inflation reading, that the core inflation print wasn't massively higher. I think it was pretty much the same month on month. So slightly more positive spin on things there. And there will be some people that now reckon the Bank of England might just keep rates or raise rates by just 25 basis points rather than the 50. But we did have the ECB rate decision this week, and they shocked markets by raising rates by 50. And we also have Bank of Canada the week before, where they did 100 basis points. So it's kind of set up for a really interesting one next week, because you also had the Fed too. Overall markets, like I said, have had a strong week, and those who think we're bottoming out, they'll be sitting relatively happy right now. So fingers crossed.
So other than the Federal Reserve next week and the interest rate decision, is there anything else that we're looking forward to?
Yeah, I mean, there isn't often where I want to wish the weekend away, because the next week in markets will be as interesting as it is. But this is one of those times, like you said, we've got the Federal Reserve meeting on the Wednesday, which will be the main highlight, definitely. And, you know, one that I'll be, you know, staying up for, 7 p.m. UK time for that. But we have earnings out of Microsoft, Alphabet, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Exxon, Coca-Cola, Chevron, AstraZeneca and Shopify, plus some other really big names as well. So if we can somehow get through that week, and we've also got Eurozone sentiment data, we've also got GDP readings from the US and another inflationary print. So if we can get all through that next week sitting okay, I'll feel super confident. But there's so many hurdles to navigate. So, yeah, let's see how we're doing next week. But real, real busy one. Really interesting as well.
And it won't just be the results that they're posting. It will be what they're saying about the months to come that people are looking for.
100%. Yeah, that forward guidance is going to be so key.
Okay, Sam, well, thank you very much for joining us. Speak to you next week.
Thank you, Simon. Take care.
Welcome back. News of the state of Britain's economy makes for depressing reading. We had the latest inflation figures out this week. It's bad and likely to get worse. That's the summary. But what's been perhaps less talked about, though no less worrying, is separate ONS data showing the government's borrowing figures for June. $2.4 trillion in debt, but also included within the information was the interest payments involved in servicing this borrowing. They're at the highest level on record. And the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility has predicted that interest payments will reach $87 billion this financial year. Huge figures, Simon. Why do they matter?
Because there has been... Okay, I hesitate to draw this comparison because people really don't like this comparison because it's not the same, okay, as the whole, you know, household spending, credit card, national debt kind of thing. But there's a similar mindset going on of this, like, don't worry about the debt, just worry about the monthly payments or the payments and the interest. And this presumption that the interest would always stay really quite low. So whilst we have run up all this debt, it's okay because actually the interest payments are pretty low. And they were for quite a while, but they've started going up quite a bit. So we're feeling a similar vibe to the rest of the individuals in the country on our government debt. And it's starting to get to the point where people are noticing the interest payments. So rather than going, well, the interest payments aren't really a worry, actually, on these government bonds. This money's so cheap, inflationally into it, it's fine. Actually, inflation is driving it up because some of this stuff is index-linked to RPI, which has reached 11.8% now. And people are starting to notice it. Now, there is one important element here, which is for a fair bit of this, actually it's rolled up and just paid at the end on top when the coupons are rolled up and when the bond is repaid at the end, it's all repaid at the end. Okay. So that means it's not necessarily such a pressing immediate issue, but I think that there is an issue here, which I think we're going to do some more stuff on actually. And I think make a good podcast in the future of what if inflation doesn't go away? There's this still this presumption that this inflation spike is only going to last a limited amount of time. But there's the what if this sticks? I mean, then we are definitely going to have a problem. I mean, you know, the thing is, we've run up a lot of debt dealing with a number of crises in recent years. We did it for the financial crisis and then we did it for coronavirus and interest. Spicy.
Lee, what if it does stick?
Well, I mean, Simon's right. And actually, the forecasts keep talking about inflation, you know, potentially spiking and going back down. But there is a kind of what if that doesn't happen. And as we have seen in recent years, there's a lot of what ifs actually that do come true. So, I mean, it's quite difficult to really know what's going to happen. All I can say is a lot of, you know, general public see these figures and they're so massive to even comprehend.
1 billion, trillion, billion. Exactly. It's sort of
it's so hard to digest. I remember many years ago being in New York and they had a massive debt calculator and it was ticking higher of government debt. And I don't know if that calculator is still there or not, but I remember standing by it and looking up at it and looking at the figures going, wow, that government debt figure looks massive. I mean, it looked so massive then. So if maybe it's had to have a few extra digits put on that now, I'm not entirely sure. But one thing I will say about this is that it is a potential one of many headaches for whoever's going to be the next prime minister, because it might really factor and influence what kind of handouts and what kind of spending can be done. And we're coming off the back of quite a few years of different support packages. We've had a new support package come out last week for households, you know, 8 million households that are going to get £630. I mean, you know, there's a lot of these kind of political moves and things that might be difficult to be able to dish out if interest keeps rising on our debt.
Yeah.
And it's just, I looked at these figures, George, honestly, I just thought, I mean, it's proper Dr. Evil style, isn't it? It's like $1 trillion. I mean, it's just like numbers on a screen, but they're so frightening that I don't even know if I'm frightened by them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get it. It doesn't seem real.
No.
Simon, was this not the, I suppose, the purpose, the raison d'etre almost, of the Cameron government to try and bring down government borrowing and debt? And we had, you know, now over a decade of cuts, lots of those coming home to roost. I was talking about council tax yesterday, and one of the reasons why Kent Council, for example, are talking about raising council tax is due to budget cut, partly. Obviously, there's lots of different reasons, inflation one of them, et cetera, et cetera. But is it imperative to bring it down? And if so, where do you cut to do so?
Yes, well, there's a difficult scenario there, isn't it? I don't think anybody's really up for austerity again. Definitely austerity is a mindset. There's a question about how much of it there was, but certainly, you know, you're starting to see the swing back from it now with people whose wages were, certain public sector wages were held down for many years and so on. And now that all of a sudden inflation's up and they're saying, well, look, you know, not only is inflation up, but we haven't had a real terms pay increase in years. So I think it would be quite difficult to go back to that. I think there is an issue where, and I mean, this is a debate that's going on at the moment, isn't it? Between the Conservative Leader Party, between the Conservative leadership candidates, this whole promise of tax cuts versus, hang on a minute, we can't afford tax cuts. So, yeah, it's tricky. I mean, we sorted out the finances.
But
coronavirus came along. Is it imperative to do it? Yeah, I don't know. It depends on your economic school of thought. I would say that you definitely need to be seen to be getting a handle on this kind of stuff and not just continually living above your means. There are people on the other end of the economic spectrum who would argue that it's absolutely fine to do so. And that, in fact, you should be borrowing to invest and, you know, improve productivity and things like that. I think one of the things that we can't do, which some people seem to think we can do, is just keep increasing spending and cutting taxes at the same time. Something's got to give, unless we just plan on totally living above our means forever. But one of the methods of living above your means is, for example, very low interest rates and quantitative easing. And inflation creates a bit of an issue for doing some more of that.
Yeah. Can't say I've ever thought of myself as having an economic school of thought. But maybe I do. Anyway,
well,
finally.
Keynesian. If you're Keynesian, then obviously you believe in the sort of spending money to generate money, pay a man to dig a hole and stuff like that. If you're from the Hayek, the Austrian school of economics, then you're much more keen on, you know, living within your means, cut stuff back down.
Yeah. Still don't know. Right. Finally, we all know inflation is eroding the value of our savings pots. So you have a reader question. Nice problem to have, another nice problem to have, but especially in this current climate, but an important issue. So this is not me again. This is the reader. I have £60,000 saved in my cash ISA with a high street bank. I can feel you both going, oh no. I've since checked what interest rate I'm on after they'd read your articles. Very good. And discovered I'm earning just 0.4%. I was wondering whether there's any point in keeping the cash in an ISA. And if so, how hard would it be to transfer it to another provider that pays more? There's a few questions in this. Also wondering whether, with mortgage rates also rising, it might be sensible to instead use the money that's in the ISA to pay off some of our mortgage. Our current rate is only 1.4%, and that is fortunately fixed for a further 3 years. So maybe I'm being overly cautious. What would you advise? And is there anything else I should do with my money, such as investing? So there's a few things there, isn't there? Firstly, Lee, cash ISA, 0.4%, £60,000. Is there any point keeping the cash in the ISA? How hard would it be to transfer to another provider that pays more? And with your knowledgeable head on there, sort of what rates can you get if she's, or he is thinking, I don't know why it's a she, that they are thinking of moving it to another cash ISA?
Well, first of all, I should say, Georgie, in this, I think there's a lot of people in a kind of similar boat. You know, I'm not talking about having £60,000 of savings.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely.
Having a savings pot, having it in a kind of dud rate, not sure whether they've got the stomach to invest because they're worried about potentially losing money, and also having a rock bottom mortgage rate and thinking to themselves, probably not going to have a rock bottom mortgage rate forever. You know, might be fixed for 5 years. You might already be a couple of years into it, like this person is. So all of these kind of factors at play in deciding what it is that you need to do. Now, the one thing I would say that you definitely need to do, and this person in this question, is you've got to get out of that rate. I mean, 0.4% on £60,000 is just absolutely criminal. And we're at a time now where savings rates are going higher. Unfortunately, inflation is high, and that means it's impossible to kind of get anywhere that's inflation beating. We sort of the figure up to 9.4% this week, and actually the Best Buy ISAs haven't gone up as high as non-tax-free accounts in terms of rates, but you can still get 1.5% on an easy access cash ISA. That's a percent higher than this person's getting. And on 60 grand, that's a pretty sizable amount. Now, some people will be listening to this going, well, what's the point of a cash ISA? Is there a point of having it in a tax wrapper, especially now because of the personal savings allowance? Basically, you can have tax-free savings on up to £1,000 a year if you're a basic tax rate taxpayer, or 500 quid if you're a higher rate taxpayer. I still think there is a point of having an ISA wrapper. I would not forfeit that wrapper that's been built up, because rates are rising. It is a great tool to be able to save away from the tax man, and you could potentially start dipping your toe into a stocks and shares ISA. Yeah. You know, the thing is, I think that what's happened, we've come off the back of the pandemic where it felt like everyone and their dog was becoming a bit of a novice investor, you know, getting involved in putting cash in investment accounts and getting a little bit more confident with it. And then we've had some stock market wobbles and people are a little bit nervy again, I would say, about potentially getting involved. But, you know, at the end of the day, as I pointed out earlier in the podcast, it's more likely that you're going to get somewhere nearer inflation busting returns if you do invest. But it's not a decision to be taken lightly. You need to go off and you know, do some research and think about whether that is right for you. In terms of the mortgage thing, again, overpaying a mortgage is one of those things that can kind of get people, there's a lot of opinions about whether or not you should overpay on a mortgage or not. Now, really, you should be maxing out things elsewhere before you start thinking about, I would say, overpaying on a mortgage. And what I mean by that is, are you paying in the maximum percentage that you can pay in into your pension? Are you tucking away money? It seems like this reader is. Are you tucking away, you know, an emergency rainy day fund? Are you tucking away money potentially into some investing? And are you maxing out everything that you could potentially do? Which actually goes back to the kind of FIRE stuff that we were talking about earlier. Now, personally speaking, I do think it's worth, if you can, if you tick those boxes, if you are doing those things, to potentially overpay the mortgage. And I think I've said this on the podcast already, but I locked into a 5-year mortgage fix under 1% last year, which is just, you know, mad. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't know what's going to happen by 2026 when it will be time for me to remortgage, but I think it's sensible to be overpaying the mortgage a little bit. I'm not talking about hundreds and thousands of pounds. I just use one of those overpayment calculators that you can easily find online. Decided that I could probably stretch to a couple of hundred quid a month to go into it. Worked out how much interest that would save me. These calculators are great. You can usually get them at your lender that will show you what impact it will have. And you need to obviously also check the terms and conditions of your mortgage, because there are penalties for overpaying too much. But even just a couple hundred quid over that 4-year period knocked off a sizable chunk of interest, and it gives me that kind of flexibility and potential option in 4 years' time to say, do you know what, I might reduce my term down because I've paid off a little bit more of the mortgage than was initially expected. But it doesn't work for everyone. You need to go away. You need to really crunch the maths and figure out, you know, what it is that you want to achieve. I mean, the one thing I would say, though, is rates are likely to, when you remortgage, to have gone up, unless you know, you qualify for a lower LTV, but even then it might still be heading up. So it is well worth considering all these things. And it's one of those kind of boring jobs that you need to sit down for a couple of hours and really crunch and think about.
I mean, it's important to point out, we don't know really anything else about this person's finances than the 60,000 in a saving in a cash ISA. There might be, you know, the emergency pot in the easy access savings account, which we'd obviously say get that in place first before you then start looking at other things.
Yeah, and one thing I would definitely say is that I wouldn't be tempted to use any of this £60,000 to overpay the mortgage. Like, I feel like that's a pot that should be getting built on rather than being reduced, because to have built up a pot that high is a good achievement. And my first mindset would be, how can I keep adding to this pot, getting an okay return on it? I would say that overpaying the mortgage, unless you're up about to, the only time I would say that it potentially might be worth it is if you're about to remortgage and you might need, you could potentially chuck a few grand at it to get a lower LTV and potentially get a lower rate of interest. That can be worthwhile. But personally speaking, I think that this kind of pot of cash, I'd be looking to build on it. And if you're thinking about overpaying the mortgage, I'd be looking at that as a separate thing. But that's just my view and my own opinion.
Simon Lambert?
I think if you're comfortable with your mortgage payments and your mortgage is on a low amount and you're on a fix that lasts for some time, then maybe just stick to that. But you know, I'm not a financial advisor. That's what I would probably do. And I would probably start trying to invest some of the money, but invest it in dribs and drabs. If you're worried about a big fall hitting you, you know, start now and start and plan to invest it over the next, some of it over the next 6 months. It's not an all or nothing game. You could do a bit of all three. I would definitely get off the low rate cash ISA though. Yeah. Definitely do that bit.
Good advice. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to read the debate in reader comments and find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.